Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Michelle Forto standing in for Robert again this evening, and boy, do we have a show in store for you tonight. So I'm going to hand the reins right on over to Alex Stein. Alex, what's been happening today?
It has been a fantastic day for Iditarod and for race fans. Just a lot of stuff happening, but of course the big story is we not only have a winner, but we have three teams in at this point. Mitch Seavey won his third Iditarod. He is once again the oldest musher ever to win at 57 years old. He broke the record previously set by Dallas by nearly 8 hours. And we've been watching Mitch throughout the race just completely going much, much faster than almost anyone else out there. Routinely there he would be going close to 10 miles per hour, and most of his closest competitors were going at least a mile per hour slower. So Mitch finished this afternoon around 3:40 Alaska time with a time of 8 days, 3 hours, 40 minutes, and 13 seconds. And, you know, it seems like it was just a while ago that we got used to the idea of having winning teams come in under 9 days. And this is really opening the door that we could, you know, at some point in the next few years, have a team that would break the 8 day barrier.
Yeah, it's absolutely extraordinary. I would have to say, though, that conditions play a big part in whether the teams are going to run at a higher rate of speed or not.
Oh, absolutely. And definitely Mitch was helped and everybody else was helped by having a good fast trail. Pretty much a lack of major weather events. You know, there certainly was weather and there were fluctuations in temperatures, but we didn't have the type of storm that we've seen sometimes that will just either completely slow down groups of teams or in some cases stop the race altogether.
Right, absolutely. But you know what else is remarkable is how the racers after Mitch came in virtually just as competitive. I mean, honestly, we're looking at only a five-hour difference, correct?
Five minutes.
Oh, five. No. Dallas came in a few hours after Mitch, correct?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Dallas came in a few hours after Mitch, 2.5 hours, and then there was only 5 minutes between Dallas, who came in second, and Nick Pettit, who was third. And I have to tell you, I've been watching the two of them all afternoon, and Dallas started out about, by the time Nick left White Mountain, Dallas was about 5 miles ahead of him, and Nick kept whittling it down and whittling it down, and at the end there was a little bit less than a mile separating them. And I have a feeling that if this race had been 20 or 30 miles longer, Nick Pettit easily would have passed him and come in second place.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that first, second, third place finish was phenomenal in its own right. I think we've got another race going on, don't we?
Yeah, we sure do. I mean, it looks like we have coming in probably a little bit later tonight will be Yor Olsom and Jesse Royer. It looks like Jessie still has 16 dogs on the line, so it looks like she is probably going to finish with all 16 unless something happens to one of them, and you know she has to drop it at safety, which is very, very rare, but has happened a few times. Looks like there's probably not going to be enough time for her to pass Yor, but she might, you know, she might be able to give it a shot. I'm looking at the tracker, and it looks like Yor is about 50 miles out of Nome, and he's still 15 miles in front of Jesse. So that's a lot to make up. But, you know, she has those 16 dogs, and her dogs are just looking very, very good.
Yeah. Well, I have a question for you, Alex, and I don't know if you'll know the answer. How often is it that mushers finish with 16 dogs?
It's unusual. I mean, it seems like every year there's maybe one team that finishes with 16 dogs, and some teams there are no teams that finish with 16 dogs. So it's definitely not something that happens a lot. And it, you know, as we talked about the other night, it's a testament to a number of things, including really good dog care. Certainly, luck plays a part in it. You know, if a dog takes a little bit of a wrong turn, just like you could take a wrong turn or step on something and twist your ankle, a dog could have a minor problem that would cause you to drop him or her. But yeah, it's not a usual thing. And it's definitely something that I think is going to make people look at Jesse Royer in a new light. I mean, she has for the past few years been a very, very well thought of and well respected musher. But this top five finish, I think, is going to put her in a place where she could really catapult herself up into being really, really competitive and have a chance of winning. Certainly a finish like this, I think, would help her attract more sponsors. Getting more sponsors would help her in terms of the whole financial issue going into running this race. I would have to think that puts her in a very good position for 2018 and 2019.
I agree. I think that it's pretty rare that a top 10 finisher finishes with 16 dogs. I mean, I think it's absolutely extraordinary. I think that a lot of people respect her, but I don't think that they find her competitive yet. I think they will now, just like you said.
Yeah. And, you know, she's had some really good finishes before. She's had five top 10 finishes, but she's also been a little bit up and down, and some years she'll have a really great finish, and then the next year she'll drop like 12 or 15 places. So hopefully this will let her, stabilize things a little bit so that she can really move into a much more competitive footing in the next few races.
Yeah, absolutely cool. So what else is going on? I mean, that's a lot just in the first few minutes of the show, but what else is going on, Alex?
Yeah, well, so we have, unfortunately, we have another dog death to report. Flash, who was a four-year-old male from Catherine Keith's team, and we talked about her as musher of the day yesterday, died early this morning around 1 a.m., about 10 miles from Koyuk. And the dog's body will be flown, I believe, back to Anchorage for a necropsy.
Yeah.
One of these days I will learn to pronounce that name. I keep hoping that there will be no more dog deaths and then I won't have to learn how to pronounce it. But that will be performed, and we'll have more information on what caused that. That's the second dog death on the trail, and then of course there was that the dog who died on the plane being transported back to Anchorage. So, again, always a very sad thing, not only for the musher involved, but I think for anyone who's a fan of the race and, you know, a fan of dogs, which everyone who's a fan of the race is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's one of those hard things to predict, to understand. You just never know. You know, they can't tell us how they're feeling. We just have to learn to watch and be mindful of what's going on with them. And knowing your dogs is a key in any of these situations. So, yeah, I'll be picking up three of our dogs later on this evening that have been dropped from the expedition. And that was something that we planned for, but we hoped wouldn't happen. But we've got a few older females on our team, on our teams, and they're just, after 68 miles, they're just basically done. So I'll be picking them up later. It's just one of those things that happens. Sadly, I feel badly for the mushers that have lost dogs, but I also understand the sport enough to know that it's something you always think about. You have it in the back of your mind, and you just hope that it's not the time or the place for it to happen. It just happens.
Yeah, and, you know, as I think we said the other night when the first dog had died, there are, you know, I think this year there were, I believe, somewhere around 1,200 dogs who were starting this race. And, you know, obviously you don't want, as either a musher or as just someone who loves dogs, you don't want any of the dogs to die. But when you have that many dogs, doing something that is really a high energy sporting event, you know, I don't want to be callous and say it's inevitable, because we've had a bunch of years with absolutely zero dog deaths, but a couple is not statistically large. You know, you always want to do everything you can to have as few as possible. And as you said, when it happens, it's very sad, and it's an awful thing for anyone to go through.
Absolutely. So what do you think is going on with the little group that's hanging out in Unicolete?
How big a group are we talking? I wasn't aware of the group in Unicolete. I was looking at the group in White Mountain.
I saw a little blurb on one of my Facebook friends that said that there's a small group hanging out in Unicolete, and I just didn't get an opportunity to read about that. But I understand there is a larger group in White Mountain. Isn't that right?
Yeah. I'm just looking at it right now. It does look like there's a bunch of people who are in Unalakleet, and a few who have left relatively recently. Dave Delcourt, Monica Zappa, Geir Helvik, Justin Steelstra, Trent Herbst, Larry Daughtry, and Kristen Bacon are all there in Unalakleet. You know, Unalakleet is one of those places that a lot of people who've run the race a bunch of times really, really like. They really enjoy it. The entire town kind of goes out of its way to be hospitable and to be welcoming to people. It's kind of a chance to recalibrate a little bit, because you're on the Bering Coast, and people have said it's a different kind of race once you're there, that it's less of the, you know, it's sometimes a faster race. There's a lot of times a lot more wind on the coast. So it's a little bit of a different thing. I know also that there's a pizza place there that is very famous. I believe it's Peace on Earth Pizza. And a lot of times Iditarod fans will be studying the tracker, and they will figure out when their favorite musher is going to come in, and they'll order a pizza They'll call up the pizza place, order and pay for a pizza, and then they will come and deliver it to the musher's sled as they come into the checkpoint.
Yeah, it's very cool, actually. It's something that Robert has spoken about on many occasions, about how getting the Unicolite will be such a treat because of the pizza. So I understand that lots of them enjoy that little pizza joint there.
And you know, I believe the mayor of Unalakleet is still Mitty Johnson, who's an Iditarod veteran, and he is usually one of the people who's preparing food and cooking pancakes for people, and it's just... It's one of these, you know, it's not like a small village because it's relatively large, and it's one of the few places on the trail where there is that's big enough for commercial airplanes to fly in and out. But they really just go all out in welcoming people. So it's a pretty fantastic community, from what I understand.
Right. So you haven't visited Unicolite.
Not yet, but I'm gonna fix that. I think next year.
We should plan a trip together, Alex, because I haven't been either.
Excellent. So I'm looking also going back towards the front a little bit. Wade Mars, Ray Reddington Jr., Pete Kaiser, Ali Zirkel, and Paul Gephardt are all in White Mountain, getting ready to complete their mandatory 8-hour rest there. And in fact, Wade Mars should be leaving right about now. And that's going to be an interesting group of people to watch. The 6th through 10th place. I think there's going to be a lot of jockeying for them. Also, Michelle Phillips is, I believe, almost at White Mountain. So she's certainly someone that I wouldn't count out for getting a top 10 finish either. And then way back at the back of the pack, for a long time we had Ellen Halverson, who was the Red Lantern, and she is a veteran musher. She is sort of famous in Iditarod circles for being a relatively slow, someone who travels at a slower pace. She's the only person who's won the Red Lantern twice. She was actually, I believe, withdrawn from the race a couple years ago for being too far behind. And she scratched in Koyukuk this afternoon. She was over 300 miles behind the leaders. So it was getting to the point where it was going to be stretching, you know, the infrastructure of the Iditarod and the staffing very, very thin
right.
to have her continue in the race.
Right. Well, you know, with the pace that they're setting at the front of the pack, it's making it very interesting for mushers in the below top 20, okay? That's where I'm seeing it really going to take some effect on these other mushers that are rounding out, you know, 21 through 66, which is Cindy Abbott right now, is really going to change how they're going to have to start thinking about training up their teams. I'm wondering if Iditarod is going to think about maybe making this where we've got two races.
You know, it could be at some point, and I've been listening to some of the people talking about what's going on with that and saying that we're reaching the point where someone who can't finish in under 2 weeks is really not going to be able to complete the race going forward. And it used to be up until I think 6 or 7 years ago, they would have the finisher's banquet 2 weeks after the start, and it was unusual to have all of the teams in before the finisher's banquet. And then they would have a Red Lantern banquet for the teams that had come in between the finisher's banquet and the Red Lantern. And then we've had a few years where all of the teams have been in before the banquet, and in some cases well before the banquet. So it looks like that's another, you know, that's another cool tradition that might be going by the wayside, this Red Lantern banquet thing.
Well, what I'm saying, what I think is going to need to be considered is that we have some elitists, if you will, that are professional mushers. And then we mm-hmm. have some people that want to come up and run the race for the mere fact that they want to run the race. And they come up and they compete in it one time and they're done. And at this point, you're almost looking at, well, will I even be competitive? Can I stay
right.
within that competitiveness to keep up with these other teams and still enjoy this event? And that's why I think that needs to be placed into some consideration. I mean, you know, the UConn Quest has that UConn 300 that kind of gives people an idea of what the trail is like, what it feels like to do the UConn Quest without it being the 1,000 miler. And I don't know. I think maybe Iditarod needs to take a look at doing something similar, you know, just because it's getting harder on these rookies, you know. We've got a lot of rookies sitting there in the back of the pack that have fine dog teams that are, you know, and like Cindy Abbott's running Vern Halter's dogs. He lives a quarter of a mile up the road from me. He has really good dogs. I know their training regimen. I know his training style. She is competitive, and she's sitting at the, you know, Red Lantern position right now. And she's finished, and she's had her harrowing stories. And, you know, every year you go through something different. But, if I was thinking about running Iditarod, I would be seriously thinking, wow, what do I have to put my dogs and myself through to be competitive, not to win, just to finish within the time slot that they're putting out there with the leaders finishing in such a short amount of time.
Yeah. And, you know, one last thing about Ellen Halverson. Traditionally, when mushers will scratch, the way the press release for it is almost always worded, unless it's a musher who scratches because of something about him or her health, it will say that they scratched for due to concern for the well-being of their race team or for the health of their race team. I'm looking at the press release that the Iditarod sent out this afternoon, and it says Halverson made the decision to scratch from the race due to concern for the mental health of her race team, which is a very odd thing to talk about when you're talking about dogs. And the reason I mention this is that when there's a musher who is on the verge of being withdrawn, the Iditarod always tries to, I don't know if the right word is pressure, but gives them the option to scratch rather than be taken out of the race and withdrawn. And it sounds to me like this is, and I have no inside knowledge, this is just my speculation, it sounds to me like she was pressured into withdrawing, would rather have continued, and then said that she was doing it for the mental health of her dogs rather than just for concern for her dog team.
Well, you know, suggestion is a powerful thing.
Right. And I just want to point out one last thing. She is a psychiatrist, so she would know how to word that in a way to create that, you know, that impression.
Right. Right. So we're down to 5 minutes, Alex. Are we doing a featured musher tonight, or?
We sure are. So tonight's featured musher is Justin High, who is a rookie and I believe a neighbor of yours, or at least in the Willow Hood.
Yes.
He's 33 years old, currently in 47th place. He was born in Illinois, raised in Michigan. got his degree in applied ecology and mechanical engineering. And then after college, he went and worked in Florida for a year or two, came up to Alaska in 2009 and got a job as a handler for Didi Genro. He started doing what handlers do, which is, you know, scooping poop, taking care of the dogs, learning about mushing. He hadn't really had any exposure to dog mushing before that. Started running a few races, and he met his future wife, Jamie Krinzer, who was also working as a handler for Didi. And Didi said that the two of them, when they first met, clearly hated each other. And Jamie has tried to walk this back and said it wasn't that they hated each other, they just had different styles that would clash. But Didi said, no, they definitely hated each other. After the first winter, Justin chose to stick around and help out at the kennel. Didi was taking care of her mother, who had been diagnosed with cancer, and she said to Justin that she didn't have the money to pay him, but he said that he was going to stay around anyway because someone needed to take care of the dogs, and she needed to go take care of her mom. So then Jamie came back the next winter, and they were both working as handlers for Didi. They both started doing races using some of Didi's dogs, and they both qualified for Iditarod, and they were both going to run Iditarod in 2012. But as you know, and as we've discussed plenty of times, Iditarod is a very expensive thing to do, even if you're running with somebody else's dogs that you're handling for. And they decided that they couldn't afford to both run Iditarod. And Justin said that Jamie should run because it had been her dream to run Iditarod longer than his, so she should get to go first. So she ran Didi's puppy team in 2012, finished the race. Later that year, they got married. Jamie signed up for the 2015 Iditarod again, but in December 2014, they had a fire that caused them to lose their house. And they think that it was a stove that ignited sewing supplies for a small sewing business that they were running out of their house. It spread to their cabin and burnt everything down. And they were in the process of rebuilding when, once again, their house burned down in 2015 with the Sockeye fire that was just devastating to a lot of people in the Willow area, including Didi Genro. So they had a daughter named Isadora, who was born in January 2016. And Justin has said that having a one-year-old daughter is really good training for the Iditarod because it gets you used to doing a lot of things when you don't have very much sleep. But he also said that it left him going into the race already tired before he had even started. He and Jamie own and operate an adventure clothing and equipment business. They make, among other things, sled bags and harnesses, and a lot of recreational racers use them, and they're used in you know, mid-distance and long-distance races, and you've seen a bunch of their stuff in the Yukon Quest and Iditarod. He also works as a operation manager at a boat launch facility, and they have a relatively small kennel called High's Adventure Kennel, which is, I believe, somewhere on the order of 24 dogs at the moment. And he said that they want to keep their kennel small and manageable so that they can do most of the stuff with the two of them while they're also raising their daughter, and then alternate running mid-distance and long-distance races every other year, which is something we see in a lot of kennels run by couples. Just one quick note. Their dog, Stout, was one of the dogs who was on the same flight as Smoke, the dog who had died a few days ago from hyperthermia. And Stout, when the plane landed, one of the vets noticed that Stout was overheating and took him and quickly put him into a snowbank to help cool him down. And Stout is now back home in Willow, and Jamie says he's completely back to normal. And the dog's full name is Colonel Stout, and he was named after Didi Genro's late father. So it all kind of loops around to they met, fell in love, and got married after working as handlers for Didi Genro, the great longtime musher.
Right. They do have a very romantic Iditarod story to tell. That they do. And they have bounced back tremendously from the two fires that they sadly endured. Luckily, no one was ever hurt or injured from those fires, just property damage. Alex, we are out of time. We ran over a little bit again. Hopefully everyone can still hear us. If they click on the podcast, I'm sure they can. Streaming is over. But we will be on with you tomorrow again at 7 o'clock.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Michelle.
Have a good night. Bye-bye.